This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We hope you'll stay tuned. This is a special edition of Full Logic Reverse, recorded at the Grassroots Media Conference in Austin, Texas, in October of 1999. We'll speak with Australian author and activist Peter McGregor. We'll talk with Celeste of Free Radio Austin, a micropower radio station located in Austin, Texas. We'll also speak with Eduardo Vieira about environmental racism in Austin. We'll also have my commentary on the Grassroots Media Conference and the situation at community radio station Co-op in Austin. The Grassroots Media Conference in Austin, Texas was a very sparsely attended event. Allegedly, much of the non-participation happening this year was due to the controversial goings-on at Co-op Radio, a community radio station located in Austin, Texas. We'll have more on that later. Despite the very few attendees at this year's conference, we were able to talk to some very interesting people and hear some good music as well. We're joined by Peter McGregor, author of the book Cultural Battles, The Meaning of the Vietnam-USA War. We're in Austin, Texas at the Grassroots Media Conference. Peter McGregor, thank you for being with us on the program.
Nice to be here. G'day.
You're also a teacher, teach media studies in Sydney, Australia, correct?
This is right. Yeah. For me, it's politics under another name. I think we're a very mediated world these days, and, you know, so to teach media studies is a way of teaching, you know, the world, society, and a bit of everything.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, being that you're from Australia, and you visit the United States, I think, fairly regularly at least, can I get your thoughts as being someone from Australia, a person who teaches and analyzes media there, and I assume is here as well? What do you think of the U.S. media?
It's really hard to say simply. I've been here probably four times since the late 70s, you know. And I think the freedom of speech you've got here is more than what we've got in Australia. Our laws on defamation and libel are much more restrictive. And I think your range of alternative media is probably broader than ours, partly because there's more of a critical mass here. You know, it's 240 million people, is it? You know, we got 19 million, you know? So, I mean, and we've actually got the most concentrated media ownership in the Western world. Murdoch owns 70% of the daily newspapers in Australia. You know, it's much more concentrated, monopolistic in Australia, whereas here I think of it as being more oligopolistic.
It's very interesting that you say that because I know many people here in the United States, of course, view the concentration of media as being a real problem. And I think it is here. It's almost mind-numbing to hear that Murdoch owns 70% of the papers.
70%, you know? Like some of the major cities, like Adelaide and Perth and Hobart, the only daily paper they've got is Murdoch. You know, the bigger cities like Sydney, Melbourne, there'll be two daily papers, one by Murdoch, one by, say, the Fairfax Empire.
We're talking with Peter McGregor. Peter, let me ask you, because I know from looking at the Internet that there's a very, very vibrant anarchist and a radical political movement in Australia. Can you talk a little bit about the political situation in Australia and what's happening there so our listeners here can understand
Sure. What's
happening in your country?
Yeah. The main politics at the moment is around East Timor. Because we're right next door to East Timor, the Australian media have given saturation coverage of the Indonesian attempt at a second genocide. You know, like the first genocide was back in 1975 when they invaded. You know, and since the referendum on August the 30th, the Indonesians have attempted a second genocide. And so most people in Australia, ordinary people, even people who aren't usually political, have been freaked out at what's been happening in East Timor. And like I was just showing you the front page in Wednesday's Australian. Front page was a story where the ex-Prime Minister Keating has denounced the current Prime Minister Howard for having Australian troops in East Timor stopping the Indonesians killing people. So it's a front page story, and activists in Australia are focusing their energy around East Timor. I think the activist movement, where we're sort of still, we're losing so many struggles, and I mean East Timor is another one where we're losing it. You know, like most people could see what was going to happen after the referendum. If there weren't people in there from the United Nations to stop the Indonesians, there was going to be another massacre. Most people could predict that, and it happened. You know, and the activist movement weren't able to mobilise people before it happened. As soon as it happened, given we're right next door to East Timor, we got saturation media of it, and the Australian people in opinion polls very quickly were writing to the Prime Minister and ringing up talkback radio. But, I mean, the activist movement is alive and kicking, but we're still on the defensive in so many ways. And, like, the anarchist movement in Australia, I think, is fairly weak. And I'm on the fringes of it. I'm like a fellow traveller. I'm not as activist as I used to be. You know, most of my energy goes into my work at the university. But I'm on the fringes of the anarchist and other activist movements. And, you know, we're not as strong as we should be.
You bring up a really interesting point, and it's one that I try to explore all the time, because that seems to be so much the case here in the United States as well. What is it that seems to keep people from developing the momentum to make changes before catastrophes happen, like East Timor? I mean, that seems to happen in so many areas. And I don't know why people don't get more motivated sooner. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I'm very influenced still by the situationist analysis of the world. You know, the famous book Society of the Spectacle. In the 1960s, the Situationist movement produced two really interesting books. And in the Society of the Spectacle, they argued that the techniques of modern domination are what they call separation perfected. And I think in the 1960s, there was more of a common public sphere. And 30 years on, I think a lot of us don't feel connected to a common public sphere the way we did. You know, I'm showing my age, you know, I'm 50, you know? But like 30 years ago, I felt there was more of a common public sphere than there is today. And so each of us are caught up with running our own private lives and fitting into the society in different parts of the society. And so in that way, we're demobilized because we don't know what's going on with the overall picture. I know what's going on in the universities because I work there, you know, but I don't know what's going on in agriculture. I don't know what's going on over in Africa. You know, the world now, although it's global, but it's also, there's all these separations between us that have been magnified, and I think that's the way in which a lot of us have an idea of what's going on in a limited area. Because we're close to East Timor, a lot of Australians are putting energy into that. But, you know, there's another massacre going on, I think, in Chechnya. You know, I think the Russians now are out of control in Chechnya, I think. I might be wrong. I don't know enough about that because it's not my backyard, you know? But, I mean, that's the complexity of the world. We're much more integrated now in that globalisation sense. But on the other hand, there's so much going on in so many places that it's really hard to have the big picture.
It's interesting because when you're speaking, I'm thinking about Maggie Thatcher and her statement that there is no such thing as society anymore. Yeah. It's just individuals pursuing their own interests. And it almost sounds like we're devolving into something like that. Yeah. I mean, we're just all so busy caught up in our own daily struggles that we can't grasp the bigger picture. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, I think she was describing the tendency that people like her and Reagan and others have tried to impose, you know, in getting into government. They're trying to represent the corporate interests. And the corporate interests do not want a common public sphere. You know, what they want is people busy, caught up in their daily lives, the struggle to survive, that kind of thing. And, you know, that notion that you don't have any common interests with other human beings, let alone other living beings, you know, but you only have common interests with your narrow family. You know, there's no society, there's only individual families, and then economic contracts. That's the other thing she said, wasn't it? The only thing we have that approximates society is economic contracts, and that's the way they want the world to run, and unfortunately they're still winning.
We're talking with Peter McGregor, and really we are talking about a cultural battle, which leads me to ask you about your book, Cultural Battles, The Meaning of the Vietnam-USA War. Can you talk a little bit about the book?
Sure. I'm from that generation. I nearly got conscripted for the Vietnam War. And I think there's been battles about the meaning of the war that have continued up till now. And I think that was evident when the Gulf War was on back in 1991. You know, that someone like George Bush said, we've kicked the Vietnam syndrome. And this was indicating that Vietnam was some kind of burden on the back of the US government. And I think it was. And I think it was a burden for Australia, a burden for the US, burden for the West, if you like, you know, because it was one of those wars that was playing out the end of European colonialism. And it's that dilemma where basically the Vietnamese defeated the US militarily, but I think they lost the war politically. I've been to Vietnam a couple of times in 1988 and 1991, and Vietnam is still a third world, primitive, backward country. And so that's what I'm meaning a little bit by cultural battles, that the ideological meaning of the war is the cultural battle for what the war stood for. And on one level, the Vietnamese defeated the West, but I think on the broader level, the Vietnamese society now has been integrated into the world capitalist system. The USA has normalized relations with Vietnam, which means Coca-Cola's in there now. It means that Nike's in there running sweatshops. That's not what the Vietnamese fought for. That's not what you and I fought for in supporting their independence. So that's what I mean. In the broader picture, I think, in the short term anyway, the Vietnamese have lost. And so that's sort of why I've called the book Cultural Battles.
It's interesting. You bring up a couple of points, and one of them being that the U.S. has normalized relations with Vietnam, yet continues to embargo Cuba.
I can't see any rationality in the U.S.'s attitudes to Cuba. I can't even see how it fits a narrow U.S. self-interest. I think it's just like there's a fixation amongst U.S. politicians about Cuba. I mean, you would know this better than me because you live here, but I find it totally irrational. You know, because like with Vietnam, the U.S. government have been sensible. They've now got their corporations in there dominating Vietnam economically. Neocolonialism. Why can't they have worked out something like that with Fidel? Well, I think Fidel and the government in Cuba have got a little bit more of an idea of what they're holding on to. I think the Vietnamese communists have lost the plot. You know, at least Castro and the government in Cuba have tried to hold on to like a public health system, you know, public education for all. You know, like the Vietnamese communist government have lost that kind of perspective.
The other thing that I was thinking about is that most people in the U.S., I don't think really have any idea how much Australia was involved in the Vietnam War. Can you talk a little bit more about the Australian involvement in Vietnam?
Sure. Well, I think it was a joint involvement, actually. I think in some ways Australia couldn't have gone in there without the U.S., you know, which is interesting now with East Timor, because we've gone in there without the U.S., you know. But with Vietnam, Australia had two concerns. One was the Red Peril, communist influence with China as being the big bogey, but the other was the Yellow Peril, Asians. And from our point of view in Australia, the threat was real. I mean, I can't see how the USA was threatened by Vietnam going communist. you know, like geographically, geopolitically, you know, it was, you know, whereas for us in Australia, you know, World War II, as you know, the Japanese got down to Darwin, you know, Japanese submarines got into Sydney Harbour. Australia felt militarily under threat by the Japanese, and that was the Yellow Peril, Asians invading, you know, part of the gravity effect of like the North, you know, easily flowing down into the South, you know. But then along comes Vietnam, and it was a combination of the Yellow Peril with Asia threatening again, and also the Red Peril. So I think when Australia joins the US in the early 60s in sending advisors, it's a joint commitment. You know, the US probably wanted Australia there, so there was many flags supporting the US's involvement, but Australia desperately wanted the US there as well, because there was no way Australia could defeat these millions of Asian communists who were going to come down the archipelago, you know?
We're talking with Peter McGregor, and we're talking in part about his book, Cultural Battles, The Meaning of the Vietnam-USA War. Peter, we were talking earlier off microphone about the situation of the Aborigines in Australia. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. When we were talking off mic, you were also talking about Mumia Abu-Jamal and talking to him, and he said this country, the USA, is founded on genocide and slavery. Australia's not all that different. Australia, white Australia, and the name only comes from the British settling there or invading there. But, I mean, basically, it was similar to what happened to the American Indians. It was a fairly impressive level of genocide. You know, the estimates on Indigenous Australians are about 750,000. I mean, who can say for sure? You know, who could take a census in 1770 when Captain Cook discovers Australia? But the anthropological evidence now is that there was a bit less than a million Aboriginal Australians. And by less than 100 years later, 1770, Captain Cook discovers Australia. By 1830, it's down to 40,000 Indigenous Australians. Again, I don't know how they counted them. But these were the statistics coming out of the British occupying forces. They reckon there was only 40,000 left. Now, Indigenous Australians are up to about 220,000. They're about 2% of the population. And basically, the Aboriginal community are surviving. And I was going to say they're alive and well. They're alive, but they're not very well. Basically, the difference for me between the US and Australia, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. 1988 was 200 years of white civilization, because Captain Cook discovers the country in 1770, but 1788 is when the first British prison settlement, because New South Wales is founded as a prison camp. You know, the British are trying to deal with all the people they're jailing, Irish or poor Brits or whatever, and instead of Australia being like a new world, like the pilgrims coming over to the US, Sydney is set up as a convict settlement. So I think those kind of origins are interesting. It was Australia's based on a genocide, but it's also based on being a prison camp. So Mumia's words to you, you know, sort of had a real resonance to me. You know, because I'm part of that white heritage, you know. I've got a Scottish name by surname, you know, but I'm part of that Anglo-Saxon and Celtic heritage. And 1788 was when Sydney gets set up as a convict settlement. So 1988 was the 200-year celebration of white civilization. Well, at that time, there was the biggest rallies that ever been in support of the Aboriginal community in Sydney. Sydney was the place where the celebrations were going on. So for the last 10 years, Aboriginal issues have been on the agenda in Australia in a way in which I don't think American Indian issues are on the agenda in the USA. I might be wrong, but I mean, my impression there is that American Indian issues are not on the agenda in the newspapers every day. Whereas back in Australia, we're having a huge debate now about what we're calling reconciliation, and the big push there is to get the federal government to apologise for the invasion, the genocide, and the stolen generations. And all the state governments, like New South Wales, Queensland, Victoria, all the state premiers have actually given a formal apology. But the federal Prime Minister, John Howard, still refuses to give an apology. And there's a big movement now. Because he won't give an apology officially, there's a people's movement that is giving an apology.
It's interesting that you bring up that topic of what's happening here in the United States, because any reconciliation that is being done, what little there is of course being directed at trying to reconcile the issue of the remnants of black slavery here in the United States. And very frankly, in my opinion, Indian issues here in the U.S. are for the most part being pretty much ignored as far as I can see. Do you have any final thoughts for our audience today?
I think I'm really keen to be here at this grassroots media network because I think the hope lies in community organizing. You know, people forming their own voluntary organizations and then using their own means of expression. And that's community media or grassroots media. And so I was really excited that there was this conference on, and, you know, I was over here for an academic conference as well, where I'm talking about my Vietnam research, but when I heard this conference was on, I got in touch with you folks here, and, you know, I think here looks really exciting. So, keep up the grassroots, networking.
Peter McGregor, author of the book Cultural Battles, The Meaning of the Vietnam-USA War. Thank you for joining us today, and we really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks for talking to me.
Eduardo Vera, and we are in Austin, Texas. And Eduardo, you were telling me about a issue that's been happening here in part of Austin where there's been some issues around an electrical power plant and the machinations of the city and the community to try and make having this power plant, which has been affecting the health of people here. And they're trying to justify this and also, in a way, kind of bribe the community to accept this, correct?
That's right. What we have is a situation where for decades, the city has been divided racially on purpose by the city council, where part of the community, basically the Mexicans and the African Americans were moved on into the east side of Austin after the 1930s to get rid of them on the west part of town where they could develop the nice buildings and the nice resorts and the nice tourist spots. On the east side of town, besides becoming Mexican and African-American, it became a place where the dumps for the city were developed. So you had an oil refinery, an oil storage place, also an electrical plant that provides electricity to the whole city. And that electrical plant is in the middle of a Mexican neighborhood with houses right next to it. It's one of the few cities in the United States that has the electrical plant right smack in the middle of a neighborhood. So for years, the community has been organizing to move that plant out of that community, and successfully, a couple of years ago, finally they convinced the city council to move that plant out, and they had a plan to move it out by the year 2000. Well, a few months ago, the city council reneged on its word. And say, we're going to keep the power plant because we need it, and there's no other solution for it. And you're going to have to live with it. You're going to have to live with the illnesses. And basically, we don't care about what happens to your community. We're going to keep the power plant. And recently, also, the city council said, well, you know, to make up for that, we're going to build a youth center of $1.6 million so that your juice can, you know, play right next to the power plant. And, of course, the community has been outraged and continues to state the truth, which is that there's racist implications in all of this work by the city council and by the movers and shakers of this town. And, of course, what is considered the alternative progressive media like the Chronicle keeps trying to destroy these community organizers by saying, how dare you call, you know, the city council racist? You know, these are, you know, nice, liberal, white people of gentlemen of decent background. Why the hell call them racist, you know? And they continuously undermine the work of the community and pointing out to the racist factor, but there's a major guilt problem. A major therapy problem that some of these people have to go through in terms of recognizing that recognizing their own racism and letting it stand for what it is. Instead, what we have is one particular media that anytime somebody raises the question of race, then they attempt to destroy, to character destroy that community or that organization.
One of the things that I think has been coming increasingly clear across the United States is what has been labeled environmental racism, whereby power plants, trash burning facilities, and so forth and so on, of course, are put in neighborhoods and areas of cities or geographical areas that are occupied by Latinos or blacks, or more importantly, perhaps, people who are poor and really have a difficult time trying to fight to keep these types of things out of their neighborhood, which, of course, are never placed in more affluent communities, which, of course, tend to be white. What I'm hearing you say, which almost makes it different, it sounds like here in Austin that where in some areas the quote-unquote liberal alternative media will come to the aid of some of these communities, I'm hearing you say that that's not happening here in Austin at all. In fact, an opposite stance is being taken.
Yeah, we have a very powerful so-called alternative media, which is the Austin Chronicle, that it's like a commercial outlet. They make a lot of money on everything from the south to by southwest to all major other commercial promotions. But yes, that media is very protective of being labeled racist, you know. And it doesn't matter who when you point out to some part of a policy that has racist implications, then these other people will go and undermine that, will go and try not only to undermine it, but go and try to destroy the people in the community that are raising those questions, because they are ashamed. They are ashamed, and they don't want to see themselves labeled as racist. And what it is a reflection on their own racism, but it's also a continued domination of communities of color, of communities that are in resistance. And just like in Chiapas, the government of Mexico is working on destroying the indigenous communities because they point out to a problem and they are an example. And so what this media is doing is making an example and saying, if you rebel, if you resist, we will be participating in destroying you.
This is Full Logic Reverse. We'll be back in just a few moments.
Yeah.
with Celeste from Free Radio Austin here in Austin, Texas. Free radio station broadcasting at 97.1 FM. Celeste, how you doing?
I'm doing fabulous, thank you.
Well, great. Can you tell us about Free Radio Austin and talk about what you're doing with MicroPower down here?
Free Radio Austin is a cooperative-run, community-run station that's been around for about 8 months now. And basically, it's open to the community. We have meetings every week, and people can come to a meeting, and you just have to come to one to get your own show. And we're just trying to make it representative of what the community is actually interested in, considering that most of the stations in Austin don't represent the community accurately.
Talk a little bit more about what you're doing at Free Radio Austin that allows you to represent the community.
We focus mainly on community issues, things going on in Austin that the community can actually get involved with and see the effects of and see that they have some power over the situations that are happening to them locally. And I don't know, we have things ranging from environmental shows and political shows to just local music and then not local music. It's really open. Anyone that's interested does whatever they think is best for them to do.
Let's talk about what you do on Free Radio Austin.
My show is just a 1-2-hour show once a week, and I'm trying to do, I haven't been doing it for too long, just a couple months now, and I'm trying to do things, like I said, like social, political things that are very much current and very much like accessible to just ordinary citizens to do something about. It's kind of difficult to get unbiased information to present on my show, and I'm trying to get it so people can call in, and I'll put anybody on the air who wants to announce anything or talk about anything with me or with the other callers. But it's kind of difficult because we're just, like I said, we're just getting started in this. We're under 100 watts, so it's difficult for a lot of people who aren't on the side of town that we're on to get just reception. And so sometimes the people that I want to call in don't call in.
Call me. You're listening.
One of the things that, of course, has been happening throughout the country is there's been a tremendous battle between free radio programmers and free radio stations and the FCC and the National Association of Broadcasters. Can you talk a little bit about that?
We are actually trying to get, we're thinking about getting community radio status, although they don't give those licenses to stations that are under 100 watts. But we're doing things like we try to do one public service announcement per hour, which is something community radio stations do, and we try to keep down the F words and all sorts of stuff like that, so just so they don't have more beef with us, which they already have some. We did have a problem with the FCC a few months back when they seized our transmitter, and we got another one and we buried it, and it's pretty much safe, but they haven't even issued us a warning or anything. But something that we're doing that's different, free radio is a national movement, and something that the Austin-based free radio is doing that a lot of other cities aren't is that we're extremely open about it. We're not trying to be some covert underground operation, even though it is pirate radio. We're really, we put flyers everywhere we talk. I mean, I tell people on the bus I meet, I tell everybody about free radio so that since we're a cooperative, if one person goes down, the rest of the cooperative rallies around that person, and we want the community to be backing us too, to be familiar with our programming and with our issues so that if something does happen, we have a whole community behind us and not just, you know, a few pirate people, you know, who no one really cares about anyway. So we're trying to keep it open like that and keep it so that the community feels like Free Radio is their tool as well and not just, you know, the handful of people that run it just spouting off their opinions about everything.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
The Grassroots Media Conference, Film Festival, and so-called Culture Jam was scheduled to be a multiple-day event held in Austin, Texas in October of 1999. While this commentator has to admit that he did not attend the entire event, from my observations, it appears to have been pretty much a dismal failure. The primary reason for what appears to have been the failure of the Grassroots Media Conference was the results of a bitter struggle at community radio station Co-op in Austin, Texas. While the first Grassroots Media Conference, Film Festival, and Culture Jam had an attendance of about 250 people, according to conference organizers. From this commentator's perspective of the one day that I spent in Austin this year, it would appear that a total of 30 people attended, and half of them, approximately, were organizers and people involved with the new power structure at Co-op Radio. I keep bringing up the topic of co-op community radio because it appears that the lack of support of the Grassroots Media Conference is directly tied to the bitter power struggles that have been happening at Co-op Radio over the last several years. Co-op has seen a change in its leadership structure, and in particular, the members of its board of trustees. It appears, and once again, from a very, very simplistic and outsider's point of view, that a number of white programmers and board members were moved out from the power structure at Co-op and replaced primarily by Latinos, Latinas, and a significant portion of gay and lesbian activists. Charges and countercharges of racism and homophobia abound here in Austin, and allegations of vote fraud in at least one election to the Board of Trustees has been made on both sides of this seriously divided community radio community. While as an outsider it is difficult, if not impossible, to assess the true situation at Co-op and the history that has led up to the personalized hatred that I saw exhibited at the Grassroots Media Conference, I came away with a few conclusions. Austin, Texas has a near 50% population consisting of Latino people. It's clear that the community radio station, Co-op, should have a significant, if perhaps not majority, Latino representation on its board of directors, and apparently it does. I'm told that there is also a significant gay and lesbian community in Austin as well, and the community radio station, Co-op, should have a significant representation of the gay and lesbian community in Austin, Texas, which it does. However, it is also clear that the Latino and gay lesbian communities in Austin, Texas, did not come out to support the Grassroots Media Conference, Film Festival, and Culture Jam. One example of this lack of support comes in the form of a statement that I was told by one of the conference organizers. Apparently, a local Tejano group, which is very popular in Austin, Texas, and sells out every concert that they do in the area, failed to draw even a minimal crowd to the concert that was put on by the organizers of the Grassroots Media Conference this year. The organizers of the Grassroots Media Conference, who for the most part happen to also be the members of the Board of Trustees at Co-op Radio, claim to have tremendous support in the Latino communities, the gay and lesbian community, and a significant amount of support in the white liberal community of Austin, Texas. Unfortunately, there was no evidence of this support present at the Grassroots Media Conference that I saw. In one exchange between a reporter for the Texas Observer who came to cover the conference and who apparently at one time was a financial supporter of Co-op Radio and some members of the Board of Trustees of Co-op, charges of racism and homophobia abounded once again. It seems that anyone who dares challenge the legitimate authority of the current Board of Trustees at Co-op Radio leaves themselves open to being attacked as either a racist or a homophobe. While no one here will deny the fact that racism and homophobia exist in abundance in the United States of America, the vehemence of the attack on this reporter who happened to be white and the intransigence of the current Board of Trustees of Co-op Radio makes it clear that anyone who attempts to have a legitimate discussion of the radio station and its leadership is going to be open to the type of attack that I saw. What perhaps was most frightening for myself, and perhaps some others in attendance who were coming from out of town, was that the current members of the Board of Trustees of Co-op Radio seemed to feel like these type of exchanges were proof of a victory on their part, while it was very clear to me that this was a loss in the battle for progressive media, certainly not a victory, a more fractioning, a further disintegration of unity as compared to something that would bring the entire venue of alternative media forward. But it appears that the current Board of Trustees at Co-op Radio is more concerned with forwarding their own individual agendas of identity politics than building a strong community radio station. It also appears from the lack of support from the gay, lesbian, Latino, or any community in Austin, Texas for the Grassroots Media Conference, Culture Jam, Film Festival, and the Board of Trustees of Co-op Radio that the current members of the board appear to be in severe denial. It's also very apparent that there will be no discussions able to be taken place with the current board as it's so constituted. They seem much more concerned about convincing themselves that they're right and righteous than in finding any solution to the crisis at Co-op. I know that certain people, upon hearing this radio program in Texas, will label me a racist and a homophobe, because that appears to be the standard defense against any criticism of the current Board of Trustees at Co-op Radio. I'll let my record as a radio producer and journalist stand for itself, and while I'm not prepared to go as far as David Barsamian went in referring to this group of people as the nitwit left, I would like to say to the people in Austin, Texas, and in particular to the members of the Board of Trustees at Co-op Radio, I hope you folks get your act together before you destroy community radio in Austin, Texas. Reporting from the Grassroots Media Conference, my name is Mike Thornton. Thank you. Thank you for joining us for this edition of Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. It's been my pleasure to be part of the team bringing you this edition of the program today. If you'd like more information about Full Logic Reverse, you can contact us via email, flr@jps.net, or by phone, 530-265-9462. We invite you to join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.